Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Money makes the
world
go around the
world.
Go around the
world.
Go around. Money makes the
world
go around. It makes the
world
go round. Good job, Rob.
Thank you. Kevin and I actually rehearsed that for a long time before we went on the air. Friends, congratulations. You're getting a new Patreon advertisement from us. As you know, we've had one for a whole year. So enjoy the Money, Money song because you're going to hear it for the next year.
But you know, I'm not singing I Dream to Dream anymore, so
I'm going to miss it. Okay, so friends, you should know the drill by this point. We have 47 wonderful patrons on Patreon.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Patreon.com. That's PATREON.com.
Patreon.
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 Pat Rion sounds like a drag queen from the 80s.
Well,
don't tell mama. So as you know, we are not funded by anybody except Patreon patrons. There was a lot of P's in that sentence, a lot of explosive P's.
It's good.
Thank you.
It's very emotional.
Thank you. After I had my stone removed, there was a lot of explosive P's as well. Thank you. I'll be here all week, folks. So once again, we need your help. Head on over to patreon.com. How is that spelled, Kevin?
Patreon, PATREON.com.
When you head over there, you're going to search for
Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And once you get there, you're going to hit a button that says,
it's
going to
say, become a patron.
And you can give us whatever you got, $1, please. $2, $5, anything that you give
us. Cast album collection.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Fine.
Please, please, please. We will totally take that. Anything that you give us will be a wonderful contribution to helping us get this thing going.
Thank you, everybody.
And to keep it on the air.
We love you guys for it.
We love you.
Money, 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 marca, yana, baka, round is all that makes a work around. It makes a work up.
Right. Bump. I thought I did good.
That was pretty good.
Thanks. I'm a star. Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain. And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. You're going to cut me off? Go for it.
Yep, sorry.
I took too long.
Say it. And follow us on Instagram at the Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
From the great big state of Texas to the great white way, today's guest is a true icon of the industry whose razor-sharp wit and humor has been a fixture on television, movies, and stages for over 70 years. She is best remembered by theater audiences for her appearances in romantic comedy with Anthony Perkins and Mia Farrow, and for creating the role of Maggie Jones in 42nd Street, as well as having appeared in the 1956 seminal production of The Three Penny Opera, not to mention the fact that she was the second person to play Dolly Levi and the only person to play the title character in both Mame, the musical, and Anti-Mame, the play.
Oh my gosh. And do we even need to mention her appearances in 16 Candles, The Incredible Mr. Limpet, The Lucy Show, Here's Lucy, and so many others, plus her award-winning cabaret career?
Amazing.
And I know, as if her work as an artist wasn't enough, she was one of the first individuals to demand that the world help those suffering with HIV/AIDS when many folks didn't want to acknowledge it was even happening. This demand for helping when most needed and speaking her mind in the face of criticism is still on display today.
Don't believe us? Head over to TMZ to see her in action. To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Lucille Ball, who was the maid of honor at her wedding. I'm giving too much away. Lucille Ball, Robert Osborne, Gower Champion, Tom Troop, her husband, Ethel Merman, and oh, so many others. Here to help us shuffle off to memory lane, like you would do to Buffalo, is the incomparable Mildred Frances Ney. Carol Cook.
Carol, how are you today?
I'm exhausted from that introduction. I am so damn tired.
Carol, you have done it all. Carol, where'd you grow up?
I grew up, as they say, in Abilene, Texas, honey. But you can't hardly tell it now. I plumb lost my accent. And don't ask. I mean, I can't remember ever not wanting to be an actress.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether, I think it's kind of like people that are called to, you know, to the call for God to be a pastor or medicine or something. I can't remember why I thought that, but I knew I wanted to be an actress. And I would do little school plays. And my mother kind of played into that. Now, she knew nothing about professional theater. It's just that she thought it opened our minds. She was sort of like a rural Auntie Mame.
Your mother was.
Without the money or sophistication, which doesn't leave a hell of a lot with Mame, as a matter of fact. But she would drive us to Dallas, Texas, to see Ethel Merman and the Lunts, Alfred Lunt, Lynn Fontanne, and Jane Cowell, and Catherine Cornell. You're too young to know who.
But you
do teach history.
Yeah, so you actually got to see Lunt and Fontanne on stage?
You bet.
What is that like?
Tom and I'm married to a fabulous actor named Tom Troop, my love.
A brilliant actor.
And we call ourselves the Polish Lunts. Because they were my idols.
Yeah.
Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne. I'd never seen anything like that.
What made them so magical on stage?
I believed everything they said.
Mm.
Who they said they were.
Yeah.
I just believed.
Wow.
I believed. And it's true of all great artists.
Yeah.
You just go with it and you believe. And I remember when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and it would get very cold in Texas, very cold, what they call blue northers. I remember waking up one morning, and my mother or daddy had come into the room and put on the heater. So the windows fogged up, froze over. And I remember getting up, and for the first time, I remember walking over, seeing the frosting on the glass, and my real name is Mildred Frances Cook. And you don't kid about a thing like that. And I wrote on the window, Mildred Frances wants to be an actress.
Oh.
I wrote that on the window. And from then on, every morning, I would write a wish on the window. And my mother and daddy called it Mildred Frances's wishes on the window. I even once wrote on there, Mildred Frances wants a baby brother. And I got a baby brother. And years later, my mother and I were talking about it. And I said, Mother, that was so sweet of you and Daddy to go to all that trouble to get me a baby brother. She said, oh, Mildred Frances, it was our pleasure. But I had that kind of background.
Yeah. What did your father do for a living?
Statistician, vice president of the West Texas Utilities Company.
Wow.
And, but he died, my father died at 46.
Mm.
So, that changed everything too. I didn't get to go to New York as soon as I wanted to.
You wanted to go home and take care of your mother? And,
yes.
Yeah.
And I had, three siblings, all younger than I was the eldest. I didn't admit that for several years, darling.
Yeah.
But you can't lie about that anymore, with computer age.
Yeah.
You have to tell your age.
Absolutely.
And, which is fine with me.
Yeah.
But it was one, and then I went back to Baylor because my father died and got a master's in Greek drama.
Master's in Greek drama.
I know, darling. I know. I did Medea. I grabbed my tits and came on stage screaming, death, death, to little Crazy, death. And that's when I decided, you better go into musical comedy. Grabbing your tits and coming on stage is not your forte.
But I disagree. I disagree.
You've seen them. Well, they were perky. They were perky for a long time. Okay. But
I love this.
But I did love it.
And when you were growing up, were you listening to cast recordings
or
do you remember some of your favorites
Oh yes. Everything Ethel Merman did, Mary Martin, all of those, and even opera. I would sit. I know that seems really strange. But there was no television then, darling, and I would listen on the radio to the Saturday afternoon opera of the air with a man named Milton Cross, had this fabulous voice, and I would sing along with Ezio Pinza and then switch to Lily Pons, who was a color tour. Well, that does explain the voice I have now. I sound like a female impersonator.
No. But you do.
Drag Queens International.
The patron saint of drag queens.
Yes, indeed.
So why not California? Why not film the film industry? Did that not appeal to you?
No, Always Broadway.
Always Broadway.
Always Broadway.
When did you finally get up to New York?
Well, then I went to New York and worked at the Marty Brassiere Company.
At the Brassiere Company, okay.
When I Kid a Blind Girl, yes. And it was not my favorite thing, but I had absolutely no qualifications for getting a job. I mean, I said, I have a master's in Greek drama. They go, no shit, how fabulous. Well, good for you, honey. But that's what I did. And my first real job in show business was the famous, iconic production of Three Penny Opera, Dreigoschen Opera.
Okay, so how did that come into your orbit?
I had my coach.
Who coached you on Three Penny?
Harold Fonville was everybody had a coach at that time. And so he said, there's a Three Penny show called Three Penny. Well, I certainly knew, but having a master's degree and all that kind of stuff. And Charlotte Ray was playing Mrs. Peachum. And we know the wonderful Charlotte Ray. Now, I was working at the Marty Brassiere Company. I mean, I couldn't get arrested. You know, I'd come to New York. That's all I ever wanted was New York. And Charlotte Ray gave her notice opening night. She and I have discussed it. But yes.
May I ask why she gave her?
Yes, because she had been asked to go into a new Broadway show called Pajama Game.
Oh.
And she gave her notice opening night.
Okay.
And the late, great Charlotte Ray. And the management was, I think, rightfully pissed at her for doing that because she stayed. She gave no hint that she was leaving. And so she wanted to open in the show, which any actress worth her salt would do that. Yeah,
absolutely.
Absolutely. I don't blame her at all. But the minute they heard it, of course, they panicked because they opened, and it was a tremendous hit. And, you know, it was down a little, it was in the Village, you know, little theater, like unheralded. Of course, the great Lotte Lenya was in it, Kurt Weill's widow. Mark Blitzstein was with us at that time. And I was younger then, and it was, I didn't even kind of know what it was about. I remember when I got the part, I went down, I played Mrs. Peachum, Charlotte Ray, I replaced Charlotte Ray, and it was very full of left wing, I mean, all very political, left wing people, and all that. And I remember people saying, don't discuss politics, Mildred Francis. My name was still Mildred Francis. Mildred Francis, honey, I didn't even know who the president was, so what the hell did I know? And I said, oh, okay. But I'll tell you, getting that show was, it was extremely theatrical in my life. And by that, it had such an impression on me. It was such a hit that people came down, producers, and wanted Lotte Lenya, to take it to Broadway. She refused. She said, this was conceived down an alley in Germany, and that's the way it will be. And nothing Hollywood about it. Nothing. It was fabulous. But in the run of the show, Mrs. Peachum sings very bitter songs about first feed us, and then you talk right and wrong. You warn us you're about to lift our dresses. You know, it's first feed the face and then talk right and wrong. And it was bitter. Well, by the time I'd been in the show maybe a month, I began to get ready to go to the theater at night. I had my day job. But I would go, well, I'll just wear the black stockings. I won't have to change. Then I thought, I won't wear any makeup. I had to wear a putty nose. So I'll just wear no makeup. I'll wear a babushka over my head. I looked like Three Penny Opera before I even got to the theater. it had a tremendous effect on me, and everything was dark. Everything was bitter. Everything was fabulous, but it was a sordid piece. So one day, as I said, by the time I got to the theater at night, I no longer put on the Mildred Cook face. No, I looked like Mrs. Peacham when I got there. So I would get there, and I would look forward to coming out on stage, and I was in a spotlight, and I would sing that bitter song about people, man's inhumanity to man. I had been to the dentist that day, and they had pulled a tooth. I am standing in the middle of the stage with a spotlight on me, and I'm singing this bitter song. I feel a trickle of blood coming down my out of my lip and down my chin. And I thought, instead of going, oh, my God, I went, how fabulous. I've got blood. There's blood. There's blood on Mrs. Peacham. With that, I took my tongue and shoved it so that it would bleed more. And that's how sick I was. That's how, that's what an effect. Three-penny dry Goshen opera. And, I mean, the blood was spurting. And the stage manager's going, oh, my God, she's bleeding. And everybody said, oh, she's trying to do that. And I'll tell you, it was. The curtain came down, and I had bled quite a bit. I mean, not enough to scare anybody. But, I mean, there was blood. And all I thought was, how fabulous. I'll never be able to top this. There's blood, and I'm doing three-penny opera. I've topped myself. That was also the same night I went, I'm going to give my notice. What's a glitter and tits girl like me doing in three-penny opera? I should be doing Medea. Yes. I should go back to Medea. But it was that it was that compelling to me. And I'm grateful for having done that. To think how, and it was, it's never been done better. I've seen a million productions now of three-penny opera, but they didn't, you know, they didn't give an inch.
Yeah.
And Lottie Ligne, this bird-like little woman with this quaky little voice, go, and the ship, the black freight. I mean, the voice was like that. And very Prussian. Every night, nothing deviated. Mm. Always the same. Always the same. You know, in America, we're very big on improv and the illusion of the first time, which I certainly go for.
Sure.
And hers was the illusion of the first time, but it was always the same exact illusion. Yeah. I think that's a Prussian mentality, you know.
To have that sort of rigid ability to recreate.
Rigid.
Okay.
But brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And your cast, I mean, not only her, I mean, who is a genius, but you said Beatrice Arthur was with you. Was Ed Asner in it with you, or no?
And Joe Sullivan and Ed Asner came into it later.
Oh, okay.
But it was Marty Wolfson was Mr. Peacham. His brother was a playwright. And it was just an astounding. Many... the audiences were hugely populated by Europeans. And on Broadway, they would have cast Marlene Dietrich in that part.
Sure.
That Lottie.
Yeah.
Lottie was brilliant. Brilliant. None of the glamour. She was a whore. You know, it was of that era and down and out whores. Thieves.
And for someone like you who, like you said before, was not very political before, did you think Three-Penny Opera then instilled in you some sort of sense of awareness?
As a matter, they were careful.
Yeah.
They were very careful about, remember the McCarthy era and all of that.
Yeah.
So, but there were certainly many left-wing people, you know, and I took to it just like that.
Good. Okay, great.
Okay.
I love that.
And but it was... It was certainly one of the great experiences of for me.
And this was your first real professional job in New York. Let me ask you, we asked this to all of our guests. Is this how you got your equity card?
No, I got my equity card in Texas.
Okay.
I had toured in a play in Texas. And so I had gotten, I already had my equity
So you already
card.
Had your equity card at that point.
I already had it. But from then opened, not through that, but then I started going to, you know, auditions, all the auditions in the world. And that's where I got my craft together.
Yeah.
And I did everything from, you know, Hit the Deck, Boys from Syracuse, 80 Annie, Oklahoma Brigadoon.
Oh, you did everything.
I mean,
yeah.
You name it. And later on, Follies. I mean,
yeah.
I've done, you know, that's the thing I think that's missing now. Young people, I played the big musical tents.
Yeah.
And they were fabulous. Fabulous. That's where I learned technique. You learn to do it, not just, you know, your favorite uncle can be the funniest man in the world on a certain night.
Yeah.
But he can't do it 9 times out of 10. That's the difference.
Yeah.
And champions can do it 9 times out of 10. Make that 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
Make that 8. But that's the difference.
Did you ever do the Kenley circuit?
Oh, my darling, yes.
I did not know John Kenley at all, and I have so many questions about him, because he's a fascinating...
John Kenley.
He's an amazing... Yes. Tell us
lived
what...
Lived as a woman in the winter months in Florida. And when I was doing MAME for Burt Reynolds Theater, he sent me this huge bouquet and said, I won't be seeing you. I will see you. In the audience, I will see you on stage, but I will not be coming backstage. And I didn't understand that for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know whether he didn't. I was the one person he could have.
Oh, absolutely.
What did it matter to me? I would have loved to have seen him.
Yeah.
But he lived as a woman, but in the winter months. But in the summer, he ran the most successful summer, and you would think a man like that, because he had on men's clothes in the summer, but he was strange looking.
Yeah.
Honey, they loved him in Warren, Ohio.
That's what I heard, yeah.
Oh, yes, darling. And he had all his relatives on the popcorn machines and all this. And I did Kismet for him, I did Little Abner for him, and it didn't matter I did a number that he liked. It had nothing to do with the show we were doing. He'd say, Carol, why don't you... he'd say, Mildred.
You're
my
Mildred.
Name is still Mildred. Mildred, why don't you put that number right in the middle of Kismet? I would do a number called Red Hot Mama. That's enough to kill you right there. But the audiences loved him, and they loved it. It was hysterical.
Yeah, I had heard stories, but this is true. This is true. He would put in other numbers and all that stuff.
Oh, yes. And ask you to do it. I mean, he ran amok with it. But it was like Brigadoon and Oklahoma. It was like 80 Annie. They were all the kind of the same part.
Yeah, yeah.
The Further Adventures of 80 Annie in Scotland.
Yeah.
you know. It was that kind of thing. But I did jillions of musicals. And so that's some of them good, some of them bad. But that's where I really learned.
That's where you learned your craft.
Yeah.
You didn't learn it in
the technique of loan.
Yeah.
And going out every night.
And we don't really have that so much anymore.
No. And that's why I don't know. I don't know where people learn it. You can't sit at home. My husband and I do a lot of master classes in universities. And I go, I don't know. You can't just sit and expect the phone to ring. You say you're an actor. Unlike painters who can paint a picture, you may never sell one. But you can do that. It's hard to act all alone in a room.
Yeah.
You can't do that. And you've got to darn workshops. You have to do something like that. to be, you call yourself an actor, you've got to act to learn.
Yeah.
You know.
It has to be in front of an audience, oh, not just, you know, sitting in a classroom somewhere.
You've got to learn to work an audience.
Yeah.
Especially in comedy, because you do, in comedy, you do depend on an audience to be with you. I mean, I need to hear them. I need to hear them.
Yeah.
Not so much doing Madea.
If they're laughing in Madea, there's a problem.
You're in big trouble. In fact, I was in Warren, Ohio, doing Kismet when Lucille Ball called me. That's where the change in my life came.
How did Lucille Ball, if you excuse my ignorance, know who you were and how to contact you?
She didn't have a clue. Just lucky, I guess.
Yeah.
She was the background that she was had a group. She was getting a divorce from Desi.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is unbeknownst to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I had and to do something with her time, she decided to have a bunch of young people around her, and they would finally do a show on the studio lot, a review. And that's what was happening in Hollywood.
So she was putting together an acting company?
Well, she paid them each $50 a week, and they would do scenes, and then they were all going. They weren't under contract, but
okay.
She did it really to give herself something to do. And the little theater that was on the lot had been the little theater that was there when she had been just a bit player there, and Ginger Rogers was the star. And to keep Ginger Rogers' mother, Lela Rogers, out of their hair, the suits, the men at the top, gave Lela this little theater and said, teach the young people that we have under contract. And Lucille Ball was one of those people. And Ginger was the big star. And that was RKO. And then later on, they bought it, and it became Desilu. So that's what Lucy was doing. Unbeknownst, you know, that was Hollywood. So I'm out in Warren, Ohio. And again, no cell phones, my darling. And over the loudspeaker, I was in rehearsal. And I was playing La Lume. Again, that's where the tits enter. My whole conversation. You know, your tits came on about 4 feet before you did. Not attractive. And, well, if you don't have an act, you just fluff them up and you go on. So, the phone rang. They said, Mildred Cook, the phone, and come to the phone. So the director said, you can go to the phone. So as I was going out, the voice on the monitor sounded very excited and said, it's Lucille Ball calling from Hollywood, California. Well, I went, no shit. I thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, Lucille Ball, I don't think so. Went to the phone. A guy was on the phone named Dick Coleman. He'd been an acquaintance of mine in New York. Not a close friend. In fact, I'm sure they had tried to find me. He didn't even know where I was. I was out in stock. But he was one of the members. He was a member of that group of kids that she had together that were doing that. She was sitting around with him and Bob Osborne.
Yeah.
Bob Osborne, the famous Bob Osborne. And he was a member of the group. He was an actor then. And she said, we have a lot of people in our group, but there's no comedian that fills the bill, whatever that meant. And he said, gee, there's a girl I knew in New York named Mildred Cook, and I don't know where she is now, but I think you'd like her. Well, to make a long story even longer, they called Equity. They got my phone number, and they started calling my apartment building. I was lucky there. See, luck. The guy, it was a switchboard then. Switchboard, potato. And the guy on the switchboard happened to like me because Dick said, this is Dick Coleman. Lucille Ball is trying to find Mildred Cook. Instead of saying she's out in summer stock, which I was, he had no idea where I was. He said, he was so thrilled to hear it was Lucy. He went to the corner, got a magazine that had listing of every summer stock place on the East Coast. And there were dozens.
Yeah.
And he called every one of them till he found me and called them back and said, she's in Warren, Ohio, doing Kismet for John Kenley. They call me then out there. And that's how luck can
happen. What an amazing story.
Yeah. And Dick said, we're doing this review, and Miss Ball would like for you to come out and audition, and then you can go back to your next job. It was 2 weeks it would be over. And so I said, oh, okay. And he said, now here's Miss Ball now. She wants to say hello. Well, your mother here went a little bananas. I mean, I was really nervous. And so when I said goodbye to her, I didn't know whether to say Mrs. Arnaz or Miss Ball. So I said, well, I'll see you on Sunday, Miss R. Balls. And from then on, she always signed everything to me, Miss R. Balls. I just didn't know whether Arnaz or Balls. So I said R. Balls. So that was my first time to talk to Lucy.
Uh-huh.
And I came out here, auditioned for her, and that was kind of like a movie because I wasn't a nightclub comedian. I played the funny parts in musicals.
Yeah.
But she thought I was going to come in and have, like, numbers, you know, quick patter.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't. And the audition did not go well. But that night, Dick Coleman, Bob Osborne, Lucy, and myself went out for dinner. I was catching the plane back to Cohasset, Massachusetts for the next days. And she started talking to me. And I knew it had not gone well. But I thought, I don't care. I want Broadway anyway. Broadway! You know. And so I was a little hurt. But she said, tell me where you come from. So I start talking about, well, you saw me at 54 Below. It's those stories that I told Lucy. I mean, not all of them, but some of them.
Yeah.
That I told her about my mean grandmother and all of everything that happened to me growing up. And we all have those experiences. They're not funny when they're happening to you, but they're funny when you tell them.
Yeah.
And she thought, that was great and funny. She said, you've got to tell those stories. Well, it took me 50 years. I'm a slow frickin' study. But that won her over. Another rudder of good luck. If we hadn't gone out for dinner that night, it would have been over. And at the end of the evening, she said, I wanted you to come out here to do the show. And I went. And she said, and I know you've had your name Mildred for a long time, and we all love having our names, and we're very protective of our name, but I wonder if you'd change your name. Yes, I said. Yes. I can be, stay with the money, honey. So I said yes, and I said, what would you like to change it to? She said, Carol. And I said, why Carol? For Carol Lombard. There was a famous actress named Carol Lombard, married to Clark Gable. Yeah. And Lucy wrote on the tablecloth, she worshipped Carol Lombard. Now, she was not saying my talent was up to Carol Lombard's, but she was saying my attitude was a lot. She worshipped Carol Lombard, and she liked what Carol Lombard was in person, kind of. And she wrote on the tablecloth, you, Mildred Francis, and Carol Lombard have the same healthy disrespect for everything in general. I took that as a compliment.
That is a compliment.
And I wish now I'd kept that tablecloth.
Yeah.
And she wrote Carol on the tablecloth a lot of ways. With an E, without an E, with a K. She did it all sorts of ways. I would kill to have that tablecloth.
Absolutely. What was it like being mentored by Lucille Ball? Would you consider it a mentorship, a friendship?
It was both.
It was both.
Naturally. But, and I was, it wasn't like I was, you know, 12 years old, is she? So I was already, I was formed.
Oh, yeah.
And, but she became my mentor and my, you know, my biggest fan, you know.
Yeah.
And that, that, then she put me under contract and for a series. It was all of that time also that, that I was put under contract to Warner Brothers for two pictures a year. And
so just so I'm clear, you had a contract with Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers and with Desilu.
Oh, my
pictures
gosh.
Pictures with Warner Brothers.
TV
and,
for Desilu.
Now, meanwhile, I had met Tom.
Yeah. Yes. Well, now, how did you and Tom meet?
Well, I went to Bob Osborne. Here we go again. Yeah. Bob Osborne and I went to see a play called The Caretaker. By John Osborne, British play. And there are only three men in it. And Bob Osborne took me to see the play. I didn't know Tom. He did. I knew Ray Strickland, another young actor, fabulous actor, was in the play. So off we went to the play. And I remember thinking very well, to this day, I thought, Tom Troop, I thought that actor is one of the best actor I've ever seen. I'll tell you why, Rob. He didn't seem to be doing anything. You know how most actors, you go, great voice, so they move greater, they better, and that's all good. He didn't seem to be doing anything obvious, but the end result was theatrical.
Yeah.
I haven't figured that out yet. And
are you going to tell her, Tom? Tom says maybe.
Maybe. And I'm still trying to. We've been married 54 years. Yeah. And people said it was. And I've never thought of divorce.
Hey.
No, murder, yes. Oh, my God, yes. But, and the same for him. But, and when we got married, Bob Osborne was our best man. Now, Lucy was, she loved Tom. She liked him better than me, really. And so I decided, I thought, I'm getting married. And we went to the minister to get him to you know, do the nuptials and all. And he asked me, he said, this is not your first marriage, is it, Miss Cook? I said, yes, I just look like I've been around the block a couple of times. It's my husband to be that's been around the block. And I decided that I would try to look virginal for the festivities. I decided to wear no makeup. My idea was that I looked like Grace Kelly.
Yeah,
I looked just like the ghost of Christmas past. I mean, Tom lifted the veil. He had no idea who it was. It was like Patty Duke in The Miracle Worker.
Yeah.
He went, Carol. He couldn't even tell who it was. And then something really fabulous happened, and I had to make a decision. That you want me to tell this?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay. You're not bored, spitless, are you?
Are you kidding me?
Are you kidding
No.
me? Mike Stewart, who wrote Hello, Dolly, the book, to Hello, Dolly, it was Jerry Herman, called and said, Carol, they're looking for someone to go to Australia. Only Carol Channing has played Hello, Dolly. She'd been in a year. And everybody in the world is going, but I think someday you will play it. So I want you to come in, and I want you to audition for the big time first. And you will play it down the road, but I think he thought, you know, you don't have a shot. So it was at Christmas. So Tom said, you've got to go in. So I went in, and I auditioned for Hello, Dolly that afternoon. And I went to see the show that night. And it was entirely different from what I thought. Well, you know, people in history. I'd done The Matchmaker, but The Dolly and The Matchmaker is very different. As the Dolly in The Merchant of Yonkers is different from, you know, it's like Lilium and Green Grow the Lilacs and Oklahoma.
Yes.
And for a minute, that that for a little bit that threw me because I'd done The Matchmaker and it's Dolly Levi and that, but it's very different from the star of a musical comedy. And so that night I went to see Carol Channing and she was brilliant. It was fabulous. I just thought, oh my God, if one day I get to play it. And I thought, those are big shoes to follow, Carol Channing. Fabulous. She was fabulous. So anyway, I auditioned the next day. Again, they had me read and sing again. Then I flew back home. I was doing a small part on the Lucy show because I was doing that while they were writing a script for me, a series, and doing my movies at Warner Brothers. The Incredible Mr. Lippitt and Palm Springs Weekend, I'd done those two. And I'm in rehearsal on the lot and Lucy on the Lucy show. And they said, Carol, you're wanted on the phone. And they said, oh, you'll have to. We were on in the big sound stage. So they're sort of like football stadiums. You know, they had the seating like that. They said, you'll have to take the phone call underneath the bleachers. I said, fine. They said, take it far away because you won't be able to hear. So I went over to the phone. I said, hello. And I said, this is Carol. And at the other end of the line was Gower Champion.
Oh.
Hello, Dolly. Well, hello. And then Mike Stewart. It's so good. Nice to have you back where you belong. And then the two of them. You're looking swell, Dolly. Now, that was very theatrical.
Wow.
I mean, and that's how I knew I had it. Wow. They called me to the phone. I was under the bleachers on a studio. And then I panicked because I thought, be careful what you wish for. You may get it. Because I had problems here. I mean, I was under contract to do two studios.
Yeah.
So, let's put it this way, Rob. I groveled. I cried, offered money, my body.
Yep.
They didn't take my body. They said, we wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. We know where it's been. Anyway, negotiations happened. And I finally, it was difficult.
Yeah.
Both contracts had to be gotten out of. And I had to do a lot of promising when I came back. Yeah. But, of course, they didn't know I was going to be gone.
Yeah.
A year and a half, 2 years. It was such a... So, for me, it was... I know, even today, people say, oh, you were signed for movies and a series, and you took Australia and Hello, Dolly. And you know what? I'd still do it again that way. And because you never know.
But that's and that's what your heart was. Your heart was musical comedy.
And sure, I might have been here and sat on my ass for 2 years too, you know. I certainly had a good shot. Pictures at Warner Brothers and a series for Desilu. But to play Dolly, and remember, it was mammoth at that time.
Yes.
Only Carol. And she just been, it was only a year old when I got it. And so I went to Australia. And Tom had to finish up. I don't know what we were thinking. We thought, oh, he'll come down every month and say hello. You don't come down every freaking month to Australia. I mean, it takes you about a month to get over the trip. But he did come down a couple of times. And then he said, this isn't working. And he came down and stayed with me the whole time. And his teacher in New York had been Uta Hagen and all that. So he was a great, knew teaching so well and a great teacher. So he taught all classes for all of my kids that were in the show.
Oh, wow.
And he did it, you know, just for free. And they gave little, you know, recitals and everything. So, and they loved him. He became their mentor.
Yeah.
There were so many people in that. And they'd never had that kind of training, you know. And so it was fulfilling, you know, from both of our standpoints,
yeah.
You know.
What a great use of your time, Tom. Yeah. You enjoyed it? Yeah.
Yeah. And they really, they just loved him, you know. I mean, they, and it, I don't know. There we were, the Polish Lunts, dude.
Yeah. the Polish Lunts. I love that.
But Dolly was certainly, from my standpoint, career-wise, well, Tom and I've done The Lion in Winter together.
Yep.
We've done Gin Game. We've done Father's Day. And those have been high points in my career. The fact, because that's what the Lunts did.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fabulous.
Yeah.
You know? But certainly Dolly would be one of the, for me, one of the glowing. I mean, to get to do that part every night, you know.
Was your Dolly different than her Dolly? I'm sure it was because, you're two totally separate performers.
But I'm Carol Cook and she's Carol Channing.
Yeah.
Because I was the second Dolly, the Palmer was her name. She came from Australia. Head choreographer was in New York for 4 months learning the exact choreography. Every Fred Hebert, who was David Merrick's sidekick, came down there to direct. It had to be done exactly verbatim, like, because it was the second production. So they were extremely protective. I mean, I didn't have to do Carol Channing.
Yeah.
But choreography, all of that, set, costumes, and my costume were a little different if there was something that fit my body better than hers. But it was all Freddie Wittop's.
Yeah.
It was a replica, except that I'm Dolly. So as far as I'm different from Carol Channing, my Dolly was Carol Cook, hers was Carol Channing.
Yeah.
And the final night of Dolly, I've been with them so long that in Australia and New Zealand, we closed in New Zealand, they throw streamers, and by then people get tickets for the final night, and they've seen you do it probably two or three times already, so they know every line you're going to say. So I was trying to be the grand old lady of the theater. I said, remember, no matter what happens, darlings, we play the play. We don't go with all this shouting. I mean, we love it, but we play the play. Well, honey, I put down the paper, you know, I put down a newspaper, which is my opening, and I go, Dolly Levi. Well, it went on for, and I thought, hold it, Carol, you must not do. So I held it until we got to the Hello Dolly number, and there's a set encore where Dolly turns to the boys, the audience is screaming, and says, you know, one more time. And I turned, and like a real idiot, I said, my darlings, for the last time in our lives. Well, they all started crying. I started crying, and I made the ugly cry, you know. So I turned around. I was trying to look gorgeous, and I went, hello, Dolly, in the face. But it was an extremely, and I let everybody in the company on closing night take their solo bow on the passerelle, on that walkway
that goes
by the orchestra. Everyone in the company, I had them all walk. Everybody got to walk that, like Dolly does.
Wow.
It was so...
That's magical.
It was. And that whole thing was magical.
So where do you go from there? That's
straight down.
No. That's a pretty high place.
Yeah, it is.
You could retire on that, I'm assuming, and be happy. So what's next for you then after that?
But I came back, and then I started doing a lot of television.
You had to come back.
The show closed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But contractually, were you supposed to come back and finish the things you had left behind?
Oh, yeah. But that had only lasted a year. I was gone over.
Oh, okay.
So that was over.
Yeah.
Which, again, was fine.
Yeah.
I got to play Dolly and Tom, and I got to be there. So, you know, it was fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's who I am. That's what I did. And so I came in. Then I started doing television. Then I started getting calls to come to New York to do, like, romantic comedy.
Yes.
And that's when I got to work with the darling Mia Farrow. I got to tell you, this is darling, because she is a precious person. I just love her. But, you know, she has 1,000 children.
Yes.
You know. And all kinds and stars. And she came to my dressing room one night, and she said, Carol, she only had 9 children then. And she said, I'm thinking of getting another child. What do you think I ought to get? I said, something in beige. And she did. Oh, my dear.
Well, we
had laughs. That's all I can tell you.
Anthony Perkins was in this too,
Anthony
right?
Anthony Perkins was there. Strange person.
That's what I've heard.
I think Psycho went to his head.
Yeah.
I think that had a profound effect on him.
So we ask everybody this. What was your go-to audition song?
Did you have a go-to
audition? One, yes.
Yep.
That Mike Stewart wrote, I did for Hello, Dolly. It's the, in fact, yes, I will tell it, because it was sweet. It, Bob Oswald, it's the only song I had. And it was an original called Red Hot Mama. Mike Stewart had a friend who wrote the music, but he wrote the lyrics. Early on, gave me the piece. It was mine. He wrote it for me. It's the only number I had. I would sing that. And it's a catchy number, but I'm just a red hot mama, red dash, hot day, mama, comma. I'm not so fresh on the stalk. And
I like it.
It's a cute number. So Bob Osborne would take me to auditions all the time. I didn't have a car out here when I first came. And I'd sing that number. And he would go, oh, God. And he heard that number a million times. When our darling Bob was very ill and was dying just a few months ago, Tom and I were on the phone, and we're torn up about it. And he's saying, no, it's fine, it's fine. And I said, Bob, is there anything you want to say to us, or tell me something? It was a lifelong friend. And Bob did something so Bob that I couldn't stand it. I said, just tell me, do you have anything? Let's talk. Don't hang up. He said, yes, there is something you can do, Carol. I said, what? He said, don't ever sing Red Hot Mama again. Now, is that brilliant?
That's him. Yeah.
Then he laughed. He laughed his... I laughed my ass off.
Yeah.
But I wish I had laughed it off. But is that brilliant?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then he laughed. He said, we got to laugh, Carol. We got to laugh. When he said, don't ever sing. So, I didn't promise, though.
No, you didn't promise.
No.
It's okay.
So, yeah, they may call me tomorrow for something.
Yeah.
And I'll have to do that.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And, but I did ask out of, Martin Gottlieb was our producer.
How did you get into 42nd Street?
I'll tell you how that happened. Mike Stewart, I was walking by the, well, in all Broadway theaters, they have somebody, he can be 18 years old, but they call him Pop.
Yeah,
and
Pop.
He sits in there at the stage door. He can be a kid 18. They say, hi, Pop. Anyway, I was walking by, and I remember this for cell phones and all. So there was a phone hanging there in the hallway. And it rang, and I picked it up as I was finished. I was going on stage for the bows. And it was Mike Stewart. And now I knew he was getting ready to do 42nd Street with Jerry Herman again. And I knew that. But it's like when you know somebody and they know you. I'd done Dolly for a man. I'd done.
Oh, yeah.
He was one of my best friends. A brilliant heaven man. And so you don't say to him, is there anything for me in that? If there is, he'll tell you. You don't.
Yeah.
So I knew they're doing it, and that's that. And he said, Carol, this is Mike. I said, yeah. And he said, are you anywhere where you can talk? I said, well, I'm just going on stage for the bath. He said, well, we've just been in a meeting with Gower Champion. And Gower said, the writers of the show within the show, the two writers of 42nd Street in the show, are two men. The characters are two men. He said, let's change one to a woman and let's get Carol Cook.
Oh.
The phone went clank. I mean, I went. He said, that was Gower's idea, Carol. I never would have thought of that. I mean, but he couldn't wait to tell me. He said, so you're going to get a call. And so I got the call. And that's how I got 42nd Street.
Oh, my gosh. What was this like? I heard there was lots of changes.
Yeah.
And
well, because we opened the Kennedy Center. Yeah. And even then, Gower had a form. Now, this I'm probably saying it medically wrong, but a form of leukemia. But nothing that was not near death. I mean, he was functioning. He was always at rehearsal. Yeah. And that, but he would go to Bethesda in Washington, D.C., and have a blood transfusion. Mm-hmm. But he lived with it for years. And and he was always there, dancing or whatever. And so when we got into New York, David Merrick, who was a madman, you know, sly like a fox.
Oh, yeah, when I asked you about him later,
fox.
Yeah.
But publicity was his thing. And but he drew a line at certain things. And so David Merrick brought us into New York, and he did not want the New York Times critic to come before official opening night, and he was afraid he was going to slip in and see the show. And I'm telling you, Rob, for several nights, they told us that Gower, it was only about 4 days before the opening, Gower was in the hospital, but everything was fine. And he would be back. He'd be there probably for a second night.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't meet there. But while we're doing our shows before, pre-opening, David Merrick would put a sign or have somebody out front saying, due to technical difficulties, there will be no show tonight. We, 42nd Street people, we did them for a while with full audiences. Then he stopped right before we opened for about four nights. And we would do the show full out, costumes, everything, costumes, orchestra, everything, no audience. And he would sit there. He was the only one in the auditorium in a wingback chair like that one, like the Grand Tsar of Russia. And we would do the show full out, full out. It's very creepy.
Yeah.
It's very. So In fact, Barbara Cook used to tell it in her act. She said, Carol Cook, which I did. I said to everybody in the cast, bring an 8x10 glossy of yourself or a little teddy bear. Because everybody in that show was 18 years old. You know, they had to get off for days sometime to go to graduation from high school. And so they were all... And so we put them all in the seats all over the theater. So it looked like a crowd. And we played the stuffed animals and 8x10 glossies.
This is bizarre.
Anything to cheer us up. And before that happened, though, when we were doing full-out performances with an audience, twice we had bomb scares. That's when David Merrick, because people accused him of doing it to get publicity.
Yeah.
He said, I wouldn't do that. People would get hurt. Yeah, and he really got angry about that. But so we did all of this. So opening night, they called us in early for rehearsal. And we thought, that's odd, because you start early anyway. And we got there. And they didn't rehearse anything. We were just called in. And we were wearing badges by that time, because he was like a maniac about not letting anybody see that show till we opened. And we came in, and show started. They'd said, Gower will not be there. He'll probably be there second night. We go out, and I mean, it was going like a house of fire. I mean, they loving, and it was full of Bob Fosse and also Josh Logan. It was theater crowd. Tom was in the third row center with Ethel Merman, our friend Ethel Merman, whom we'd gotten to know very well, was our great friend. She's sitting in the third row. But it was fabulous. So Tom had said, he told me later, they tried to go out at intermission, and they said the doors were jammed, and they couldn't let people out. Now, what had happened, again, no cell phones. They didn't want people going out of the theater, because they would hear the news about Gower out. Well, I'll tell you, because Gower had died that afternoon. And David Merrick, remember, no cell phones, so they could keep it a secret. Now that you couldn't keep it a secret.
Yeah.
And somebody would tell sooner or later anyway, and they did. But the West Coast people would hear about it, the newspaper people, and be waiting out front of the theater at intermission and start telling everybody when they came out for intermission.
Yeah.
Nobody knew it. Audience didn't know it. We didn't know it. Everything's going along beautifully. Big smash, you could tell. And intermission, fabulous. We're all backstage saying, I had a quick change right before the bows. I went off stage to go into the quick change room where you change your clothes, dropped my dress and looked around. David Merrick was in the quick change room, didn't look up, had his hand like this on his chin, looked very dour, very sad, pensive. And I thought, what can he be sad about? They're screaming and everything. So I turned into Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland in front of your very eyes, which is not that attractive. As I went out, you could just throw up. I said, gee, Miss Jim, I think it's going great, you know. And he never looked up. Went on stage. We're taking our bows. Got to about 16th curtain call. And all of a sudden, the audience is screaming. They're standing up. David Merrick walks out on stage right, comes out. And the audience goes wild. And again, he looks very, but that was his humor, black humor.
Yeah. You know?
So he looked very serious. And then he screams. He held up his hand. And he said, I have an announcement. Again, they screamed because they thought he was going to say, we're only going to run 10 or 15 years. Yeah. You know, that was that kind of, and everything, and we all are applauding and everything. And they screamed. He said, no, you don't understand. And again, they yelled. And then he said, Gower champion, died this afternoon. You could have heard a pin drop. We were stunned. I remember thinking at the time, I thought, oh my God, why is he telling us this with the audience looking at us here? But then I realized they were stunned as we were. Those were his friends. Yeah. You know. In fact, they said Bob Fosse said afterwards, he said, I had to do a movie about it. Gower lived it. Mm-hmm. You know, dying. Yeah. And the quiet. Quiet. It seemed forever. And I remember I put my arms around the ingenue, Wanda Routen, because I thought she might go, whoo, you know.
Yeah.
So I dug my nails into her, like, don't move. In just a few minutes, Jerry Auerbach, who played the director in the show, stepped forward and said the line he says at the end of Act One in 42nd Street when he has to close, bring down the curtain because a star has broken her leg. Jerry stepped forward in that silence and said, bring in the curtain. And the curtain was not digitally done then. It was came down slowly, slowly. And as it came down, we just watched. And it hit. And right before it hit, you heard Ethel Merman in that voice of hers say, well, if you gotta go, that's the way to go.
Oh.
And then, thud, the curtain hit. And then all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
You know. People didn't know whether to come backstage, not to come back. You know, Tom came back and our relatives, but people didn't come back. On my dressing room door, knock, knock, knock. I opened the door. Andy Warhol, who was, when I first knew him, Andy Warhol was just kind of like this little sissy boy with the blonde hair. Now he's Andy Warhol, white hair. White. He was standing there, and he said, lovely things about the show, you know. Now you, Carol, you were whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous. I loved it. I'll see you again. Reached over, kissed me on each cheek, turned, and wafted away. And that was so surreal. Rob, do you get
yeah,
that?
I know.
I mean, all that whiteness.
Yes.
And Andy Warhol, whom I had not seen for several years. And he'd become what he'd become in the meantime. And for him to come back, and nobody, it was kind of creepy.
Yeah.
It was.
What a bizarre experience.
But it was, it was an amazing. I tell you what, if you put that in a movie or in a show, they go, over the top, too much.
Nobody would believe it.
No, they go, too much. Mm-mm. Don't do that. Isn't that something?
That's incredible. Incredible. How long were you with 42nd Street?
I played it a year. Oh, yeah. Here we go again. Then I asked out to go do a movie called in Greece called Summer Lovers.
Mm-hmm.
For Randall Kleiser, who directed the movie Greece, as a matter of fact. So I went to Greece, and I was the first one to leave. And I remember when they said, you'll have to go. Now, my contract was for everybody's for 1 year. So I felt okay about going to tell him. I mean, I was legitimate. I, like the others, I was asking out early. But that was legitimate. Well, when I said, Mr. Mayor, I've been offered this movie, and then he went, you'll never work for me again. Get out of here. And big old tears started coming down. I turned, and he said, but you will play it for me in Los Angeles. And I went, that son of a bitch, I'll kill him. I said, I'll think about it. And so, anyway, So I played it a year there. I played it a year here. And then with my buddy Leroy Reams, who was, and a lot of them, but mostly my buddy Leroy Reams.
Oh, yeah.
We love Leroy. My better half. We love it. And anyway, so we went to Tokyo.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And we played it in Tokyo, you know, for the, where they didn't understand one damn word we said. And we kept, and at the end they'd go like we had been a rock concert. But meanwhile, it had been utter silence. I went, where the frig were you when I needed you?
Yeah, that's what I hear. I hear they don't applaud, or it's a very, like, now, minimal polite applause and at the end.
Or, if, I'll tell you, that's why they took 47. You don't really have to know the story. You can watch that show and pretty much tell what's going on.
Yes, yeah.
You know, you, star breaks leg, girl goes on, and you know, and all that.
Were you there for the opening night of Woman of the Year?
That was Leroy and myself, my darling.
Would you tell us the story?
Yes.
And we want to hear it from your point of view.
Yes, because he leaves out one of the most important things. That was Leroy. I know that they think that story is like made up, or a lot of people told in the Ethel Merman book. Yep. No, it was Leroy and moi.
Tell it.
Okay. Hit it. Okay. It was the first opening night of Woman of the Year with the ever-popular Lauren Bacall, who we're never sure about. Anyway, so I said, Leroy, I have three tickets to the show. I want you to go. We're going to take Ethel Merman and moi. Tom was working. He was in the show. So off we go. And I call Ethel Merman. So we take the limo and we go in. She has a bad cold. And in the limo, she says, now, I have a bad cold. Here are some cough drops. She said, unwrap them now. And she gave me a handful of them. She put a Kleenex out and put it, and she handed Leroy. She said, if I cough or even start to cough, give me a cough drop. I don't want you. So we're fine. So everybody sees Ethel Merman coming into the damn theater. Leroy and I are on each side of her. And we're sitting there, and everybody's going, Ethel Merman, Ethel Merman, Ethel Merman. And Lauren Bacall comes out. Big applause. And she gets the end of the number called, I'm the Woman of the Year. And she goes, I'm the Woman of the, yeah! And it just splatters blue paint everywhere. You know, I mean, it's just like that. And Ethel Merman says, in an Ethel Merman voice, Jesus Christ. And she screams, Jesus. Leroy and I took the cough drops and both of them shoved them in her mouth. And when she went, Jesus. We gave her too many cough drops. I mean, that's a true story.
He leaves out that part of the story.
And it's the cough drops, which I don't
know. That's hysterical.
It's the cough drops, which she gave him a bunch. I mean, and she went, Jesus. And we did this. She went, Christ. She intended, but Jesus, everybody heard. Then we did this, and the rest was muddled. It was like, Jesus.
He leaves out the best part of the story.
Ethel Merman.
I want to ask you about your activism in terms of, you know, you were one of the first artists to help get help for those that were afflicted with HIV and AIDS.
Yes.
At a time when a lot of people were not willing to help. How did you get involved with being so passionate about finding a cure and helping those in need?
1984, 42nd Street out here. A kid in the company had it. No name for it. The plague. Gay disease. It was called all sorts of things.
Gay cancer was one of them.
Gay cancer. Yeah. I was trying to think of. Tom and I, by the way, he came from a well-to-do family. Father and mother disowned him. I told Tom, and we really didn't know what we were, naturally, we didn't know what we're dealing with. That was, everybody was afraid of him, and I must say, not because I knew anything, I know nothing, but I never thought I always thought they, the ones who had it, would be the sickly. Well, I never thought they could pass it on to me. Remember, there was a big thing about kissing anybody.
Oh, that, yeah.
And all of that. I never, in fact, when our friends, then we were hit. We lost a generation, Rob. We lost a generation of talented people. So it began to hit home with us. And at that time, there was nowhere to go to get help. I mean, so Tom and myself and about seven other people, Billy Barnes, I couldn't name them all went in together because people we know, good friends, were diagnosed with it. And we knew if one got it, his partner was going to get it. And we all pooled our money once a month, and we knew how much each, some people couldn't, whatever you could afford, $10 a month, somebody else $20, $50, whatever. But we knew we had X amount all together, you know. And we divided it up with the people who were sick. There was no agency to go to.
Yeah.
And took care of their dogs, Artsaw. It was, I tell you, just so sad I can hardly. And when we go to the hospital to see people, they put us in, heavy.
Like the hazmat
but that
stuff,
wasn't
yeah.
To protect us, that was to protect them, the patient, for us giving, because they had no immune system. So that was to protect the patient, not us. I mean,
yeah,
we were fine, you know. It started out very personally, like you're good friends. And you knew if one of them died, if they had a partner,
yeah,
they were both going to. And that... And I was out here then, and we started, but that's what we did. I remember us going to that park over here on, it doesn't matter, off of Hollywood Boulevard. And we met there one day. We brought picnic lunch, and we all decided how much everybody
sure.
could put in. And it varied, but that yeah. didn't matter. You know, we needed to know kind of how much we would have. So it started hands-on, you know, in your living room. And the benefit that David Galligan started with two other guys, it's called Stage. We just closed down this year, 32 years. I think I only missed two. If I was in New York or playing somewhere, I always said, may I have that weekend off to come, because I... But there were several of them wouldn't let me out or whatever. So, what was my point about? We started Stage, still did not have a name for it. The gay disease again, the plague, the we charged $10, and people say, "What's this for?" We say, "We're doing a little show." We didn't know. We were just making money for our friends. That's all we were doing. I mean, we weren't making money for research or anything. We're feeding people.
Yeah.
And it was hands-on Southern California. And so we charged $10. And Leonard Bernstein was our first. And then we started in, we did it 32 years. And we went from, how much time was, we finally got at the very peak of it, we did four performances a weekend. Friday, two Saturday, and one Sunday. Mm. And we filled the auditorium. And then we charged, I think it was 150.
Yeah.
200, and we started doing receptions after, so... And auctions, and we made millions over the years. And we were still hands-on. We weren't like, I mean, thank God we had the Elizabeth Taylors who had the people who donated millions. We were doing hundreds of dollars and thousands.
Yeah.
We weren't, but they did the research. They had the millions to do. But we fed and clothed and rent and hands-on.
It's incredible.
Hands-on.
Because it seemed nobody was helping. Nobody was helping, really, except artists helping other artists. The government didn't want to get involved.
No.
Yeah.
Reagan, I don't think, ever said the term until at the very end. I think somebody said he...
At the end.
I think he finally...
Yeah.
He went, AIDS.
Yeah.
You know. But it was hands-on and on the level we could manage.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, bless you for doing it, because it saved so many lives and helped so many people. And you just closed down after 32 years.
32 years.
What a great run. What a great legacy.
And we had everybody from Angela Lansbury, Carol Channing, Bernadette Peters, everybody, you know.
Well,
all our Broadway babies that right now are... You know, with this. In fact, we have a club here that Charlotte Ray started, darling.
Oh.
And about 3 years ago, and it's all of us broads that are, I'm just a Broadway baby. What? Oh, it was. And they're all of us, and it's all of us, and we meet the first Tuesday of every month at a little restaurant here, our favorite restaurant, D'Etoile. On West Hollywood, on Santa Monica. They're not allowed to, all the guys in there, nobody's allowed to come over to us because, no, they're not by that. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, if a bomb fell there, it'd knock out all of anybody over 60 in show business. But we sit there and we tell fabulous stories. We have, I went to the owner and I said, now we want to, Tom, his name is Tom, and I said, and I love that restaurant. I'm the queen of that restaurant. It's our Cheers, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah.
Where everybody knows your name.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
And I said, a group, and there's usually about 15 of us, maybe 20, sometimes 10. It just depends on if people are free or whatever. But you'd be surprised. And I thought, they're going to go, oh, here come those old show business broads. Honey, they loved it. I said, the only thing you have to do, Tom, has to be separate checks. If you think I'm going to sit there and go, now she had the mayonnaise and she had the drink, and she said, I had two olives in my drink. Well, fuck you. I'm not doing all that. So they did that. And all the guys, they draw a crowd just watching us. And the waiters, I thought, now the waiters are going to go, oh, God, we're going to have to... Everybody eats a salad. Everybody, and Chris in there makes ice cream for us all the time. Julio waits on us. And it's just, and we always have a subject. You don't have to enter the subject if you don't want to. But our first subject, and suddenly everybody wanted to wait on us. Our first subject was, what's the worst fuck you ever had in show business?
And everyone contributes.
Yeah, contribute. We all know somebody who's the biggest bitch you ever worked with? Or, you know, it's what's the worst costumer that ever put you in something? What's the worst costume you ever wore? Or, you know.
No, I'm, what, I just.
What's the funniest thing that ever happened to you on stage? And we have that. And you would not believe. It's fab, because most of us, the ages may vary 25 years, but we all know, we all talk the same.
Well, yeah.
You know.
It's the same people, same vocabulary. Yeah.
Yeah, same vocabulary. We've all been on Broadway a ton. We've all done, mostly it's Broadway babies.
So I have to ask, who's at this table besides you? You said Charlotte started it. Charlotte was one of our guests before she passed.
Yeah.
She was amazing. Charlotte started. You're at the table. Who else is at the table?
She called me Joanne Morley, Karen Marr, Nancy Dussault, Mary Jo Catlett, Millicent Martin, Jane A. Johnson. All of those are Broadway babies.
Yeah.
They're all Broadway babies.
Yeah.
Now, Eileen, oh God, my mind's gone. Don't you help to me, Tom. Jackie Joseph.
This sounds like an amazing table.
Beverly Sanders. I'm trying to.
Oh, this is fine. No, we can always cut all of these. Like, you know, we can cut the gap. So don't worry about that. That's incredible. Now, I have to ask out of curiosity, and you don't have to answer this question. In terms of the worst lay that everyone had at the table, I'm not going to ask you, did someone's name come up more frequently than others?
One of them came up twice.
You don't have to tell me on air, but I'm curious. Okay. Can you mouth it to me?
No.
She's not going to. I'm so curious now. Okay, that's fine.
It's always some straight-ass leading man, though.
Of course.
Very square. If you have that kind of tenor voice, you know.
Yes.
You sing like that, you got to be square.
Not going to be good.
No.
Okay.
You can't have that kind of voice.
So what's next for you? You just made your New York cabaret debut.
Yes.
At 4 years old, which is amazing.
Yeah. At 94.
94.
Yes, I peaked at 94.
What?
Timing is everything, darling.
You're such a brilliant storyteller. What took you so, were you resistant to doing a cabaret act?
No, I just, I think I was. I always thought of telling. I don't tell jokes.
Yeah,
and I think cabaret is like I was chicken, you know, across
the yeah.
And, I guess it was always just the theater.
Yeah,
the theater, and so I mean, I will be honest with you, Rob. I mean, I've played enough bowling alleys in my day. I know the difference. So yep. It's not me carrying on about that. But that was like a dream thing, playing a 54 Below. And Michael Feinstein's 54 Below. Because it turned out exactly like I dreamed.
Mm.
In my best dream. It turned out exactly.
Good. Good.
And I'm not goody two-shoes. I'm way past that. I'm not making points anymore. You know, they say, oh, people get ugly. No, honey, we're just not making points anymore.
Yeah.
We want you to move your ass. We say, move your ass. We don't say, listen, would you mind?
Yeah.
No. And, but it was a perfect meeting of a storm. The audience, I was on my mettle. They were on their mettle. And I can't do it without the audience.
Yeah.
The audience is my addiction.
Yeah.
That's my addiction. My first addiction is Tom. And my second addiction, though, is an audience. Because I can't do it without you.
Yeah.
It was like a movie.
Good.
You know?
And it's brilliant. For our listeners who haven't seen it, it's when you are going to do it again, right?
Yes.
Okay.
You asked me to come back.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. And you are going to come back,
yes,
right?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Yes.
That makes me so happy.
And I'm also doing it. It transfers very easily to a theater, too.
Yeah.
So I'm doing it now. I'm going to do it in some theaters.
Good.
And
it's really, really wonderful. And I'm so happy that you're doing it.
It was just magical.
Good.
You know?
What was magical for us and the audience as well.
It was like a movie. And as I said, I played the bowling alleys.
Yeah.
I know the difference.
Now,
been there, done that, had the T-shirt, sweetheart. No, I'm not a well woman. We got to move fast here.
No, I'm going to ask you one last question, then I'm going to let you go on with your day. So how does it feel to be an internet celebrity?
Oh, I loved it.
If I can ask, if you don't mind my asking.
I don't mind at all.
People are talking about you and loving you and want to put you on a pedestal. So
I tell you what. We're talking about the political thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You know what? I make no apologies at all. It was a joke. Anybody, even the other side knows it's a damn joke.
Yeah.
So, but they'll grab anything. So that's fine. But you know what? Fabulous. It's what I believe. I find it appalling. It's more than appalling. what is going on politically. It's beyond words. It's beyond. And I was shocked. I'll be honest with you. I said it to the paparazzi, got in the car, never thought about it, darling. I said, where were they? I've been saying that line since he was inaugurated. Yeah. What the fuck happened all of a sudden? And the next one, he said, well, and I said, Rob, I said, I loved it, actually, because in the Australian papers it said, our own Dolly tells the president off or attacks the president. And good on you, girl.
Yep.
It said, good on you, girl. And your top, all that stuff. Yep. And anyway, they always said things like, Broadway legend. I said, shit, my obituaries won't be that good. I said, hell, I would have done that a long time ago. And the other night Tom and I did a duet for the Actors Fund of America. Yep. And they had me come out with two men dressed as my friend Mason McCulley and another guy. Dressed as Secret Service man with the dark glasses
oh,
on.
Oh, funny.
And I had on handcuffs with pink fur on them.
Oh, that's hysterical.
They went ape.
Yeah.
And but you know what? It was all... I'm glad I did it. Don't regret it. Made my point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is going to air, obviously, before the midterms. So please go and vote.
And that's how we... That is actually... That does count.
Yes.
Voting is... That's what we can do. It's not as sexy as the other stuff. But it's absolutely what we can do that'll pay off. That'll pay off.
Absolutely.
You know, that... And you know what? When somebody tells me, I know who he is. I know who he is. But when somebody tells me they are for what he stands for, then I have to say it tells me more about them.
Yeah.
And that is sadness.
It is. It is. But a vote can change that, and hopefully everybody
voting
will come out.
Voting does it. Well, really what they should do is vote for me for queen.
Yeah.
Now.
I've got my vote.
I've got the clothes, the tiara, we can work on that. I should be queen. A lot of my friends have made it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely, darling.
Absolutely. So you heard it here first. We want Queen Carol Cook.
Carol Cook for queen.
Not Barbara Cook. No. Carol Cook.
And the profile looks good on the head of a coin.
Yep. We'll put you on a coin and a stamp. Maybe a flag.
Well. Yes. I'll put it where it does the most good.
Yeah.
We're going to be wonderful.
Yeah, you are wonderful.
We'll put glitter and tits on it, darling. We'll be fabulous.
That's what America should be. Glitter and tits and Carol Cook.
I'll go out with I'm still here.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. You are the best. Thank you so much for all your time today.
Oh,
and Tom,
you.
Thank you so much for being so kind and accommodating.
I don't want to mention it to the audience, but sweethearts out there in Radio Land, darlings, I've been on so long, you must have gone through menopause twice. Well... Personally, I've gone through it three times sitting here. But then again, it makes me walk funny. But otherwise, I'm a hell of a good dancer. Okay.
God bless you. Till next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Stars in your multitude, scarce to be counted, filling our iTunes.
They're not scarce to be counted, actually, Rob.
No, that is correct.
There's many to be counted. In fact, scarcely there's less than four. I believe there are five stars
for
almost all of them.
Five stars for most of our podcast, ladies and gentlemen. So this is how iTunes works. Thank you. Every time you rate us positively, we move up on the iTunes chart. So anytime anyone searches for theater and Broadway, the first things that come up are the highest rated podcasts.
Huzzah!
Huzzah! We would like to be there as well. So now we're going to give you instructions on how to rate and review us.
Yep,
and we hope
It's very simple and yet not simple at all.
So, Kevin, we go to podcasts.
Go to podcasts.
And then what do we search for?
You actually go to iTunes if you can. Go to iTunes. Don't go to podcasts. Yes, and then go to podcasts.
And then you search for
it. Well. And then you're going to search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
What's
our podcast.
Oh, that's our podcast.
It's lovely. I hear it's great. Rob Schneider, dead sexy.
And then
go to ratings and reviews. Click that. That's in the middle of the page. Then you're going to go to write a review. It's under custom reviews. It's a little tab. It's tiny. It says write a review. Click it. Give us 5. Don't give us 4. Give us 5. If you want to give us 4, that's okay, but just let us know why.
No, I have issues with that.
Okay. Rob doesn't want you to do that, but give us 5. And we'll thank you. And Rob always sends them to me, and it makes my day when he emails them to me. So, you know, thanks in advance.
Yeah. Kevin sometimes cries a lot, so it's nice to see Kevin get it. He just bucks up like a happy little young filly when he sees 5 stars coming his way.
That's right.
I promise Kevin that if we could get all 5 stars, I will stop doing my impressions that he doesn't like so much.
So there we go, you guys. That's all it takes.
Where am I going?
Jesus Christ.
Because I didn't get a star. I feel like Judy Garland.
Moving on down.
I'm Esther Blodgett and A Star Is Born. I was not allowed back on set after I stole James Mason's penny loafers. They looked marvelous on me.
See? This is what happens.
Give me 5 stars, you never have to hear it again.
Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.